MacCast, Saturday, April 30th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hope you are having a wonderful day, no matter what you are up to and where you're at in the world. I hope things are going very, very well. Glad to be back here with you for another episode of the MacCast. We have a pretty good show for you this week. We're going to kick off talking about Apple's latest quarterly results call. They had some numbers to post, and while it might not all be positive, we'll try and put a little more positive spin on some of the stuff coming out of the conference call. We're going to get into Apple Car a little bit, or the rumored Apple Car, I guess, and talk a little bit more about iPhone 7. We've got rumors of new MacBooks, along with new information about the MacBooks that have been out for a couple weeks now. They're getting torn down, and we have a little more information on what's inside those. We're going to talk about a little bit about Apple Watch and then a small little update to Apple FBI stuff. Don't worry, we're not going to get in deep on that stuff. I know that's been sort of dragging on, but there were a couple interesting new developments that came about this week. So we've got that. And then we have your feedback. I got some great feedback on our discussion about wireless charging maybe coming to the new iPhone. We've got a couple of listeners who need some help with a couple of items. So we're going to put some calls out to the community. Going to talk a little bit about fighting phishing and malware scams. Talk about maybe saving some money on your Apple products and ways you can go about doing that. And then I have my thing of the moment. So this should be a fun-filled and feature-packed episode. But before we get into it, I do want to take a moment and thank one of my show sponsors. And that's FreshBooks. You may or may not know that I do a little bit of freelance work. I do some web development. And I know many of you also run your own businesses, do contract work, do freelancing. And if you're anything like me, one of the things that you don't like about running your own business is all the mundane day-to-day stuff. So handling your accounting, doing your billing and your invoicing, estimating, tracking expenses, all of those sorts of things. And what's awesome is that FreshBooks is a service that makes it really easy to manage your business, do all of those mundane things, send those invoices. They make everything really simple. I mean, using FreshBooks, it literally takes 30 seconds to create and send an invoice, and you can totally customize it. They have all kinds of tools to allow you to put in your own logo, your own color scheme, so it can reflect your branding. They also provide tools for managing things like time tracking and estimating, which is really important, right? You're trying to put together that bid. You want to make sure that you're going to get paid enough. And as you're doing the project, it's very important to keep track of your time so that you know what you're going to be billing at the end of it. And that all integrates. It goes right into the FreshBooks platform. And as you're working, you could easily track your job costs and expenses. You can even use the mobile app for quickly capturing and recording your receipts so that you have everything there for your accountant later. And when the job is finished, you can invoice your clients using FreshBooks, but then also they can pay you online, which can seriously improve your chances of actually getting the money. It makes it much easier for your clients. It goes straight into your bank account if you want to set up that integration. And if you have retainers or recurring billing, FreshBooks can help out with that too. And then when it's time to check on how your business is doing, they offer detailed reporting, and you can easily share your reports and journals with your accountant. So that's integrated as well. And best of all, FreshBooks is offering a month of unrestricted use to all MacCast listeners, totally free right now. And you don't even need a credit card to get started on your trial. So to claim your free month, go to freshbooks.com/MacCast and then enter MacCast in the How Did You Hear About Us section to start your free trial. And I think you're really going to enjoy using FreshBooks. It makes running your business so much easier. And a big thank you to FreshBooks for their support of the MacCast. We're going to start the show off this week with Apple's latest quarterly results call. their results for the second quarter of 2016. And right off the bat, I'm going to tell you, Apple came in at the lower end of their guidance to investors, and unfortunately, quite a bit below what Wall Street was hoping for. So if you've been following the stock at all this past week, you know it's been really rough for Apple. It dropped down quite a bit after the announcement and in the days following. But still, Apple managed to rake in over $50.6 billion in revenue, and that was with $10.5 billion in profit for the quarter. So, you know, if you look at just that number itself, that's pretty healthy for most companies. And still, it was down 13% from the $58 billion that they made in the March quarter last year. So it was a decline, and the first time that Apple has seen a decline in revenue in 13 years. So they've had 13 years of successive quarter-on-quarter growth. And, you know, realistically, Wall Street wasn't too happy about that. So it was kind of expected. Of course, the big thing that kind of took the hit was iPhone unit sales. Both unit sales and revenue were down, and that was really the biggest concern for investors, because so much of Apple's business really is the iPhone at this point. Apple sold just over 51 million iPhones, which was a 10 million unit decline from the same period last year. And iPhones brought in $32.86 billion in revenue for the quarter. Now, Tim Cook did note that the iPhone SE demand was surprising to them and continues to outstrip supply, and Apple is working very hard on catching up. But what's important to note is, as well as iPhone SE is doing, SE sales were not reflected in these quarter numbers. So we're not going to see how that impacts iPhone actually until next quarter. iPad also continued to slip. Sales were down, though this was one area where Apple actually beat the Wall Street expectations in terms of units. Apple sold 10.25 million iPads, which was just slightly ahead of the Wall Street consensus. They were thinking Apple was going to ship about 9.9 million. Still, that was a decline of 19% for iPad, with revenue of $4.41 billion, which was also down 19% from the $5.62 billion they made on iPad in the same quarter last year. Now, the good news is it's looking like iPad may be close to the bottom of its decline and might finally be leveling off in terms of quarter-over-quarter numbers. So I expect it to flatten out and sort of become a consistent year-over-year product, a lot like the Mac. I think we're going to see the iPad on the same kind of upgrade cycle for a lot of consumers. So basically, Apple's kind of saturated the market and demand, I think, for iPad. Everybody who wants an iPad has found the model that's working for them. Apple's mixing it up a little bit with the Pro models, especially the new 9.7 inch Pro. I think that's going to jump things up again for the next quarter a little bit, but I see it kind of fluctuating. And this is just my pure estimating at this point, but I think we're going to see 8 to 10 million iPads per quarter, quarter over quarter, for a long time. Again, a lot like how we see Macs, where it's the same, roughly the same number of Macs sold quarter over quarter, and it's just on this nice consistent cycle. Now, IDC is saying that overall tablet shipments declined about 14%, so it's not just Apple that's getting hit, and they did note that there is increased interest in what they're calling detachables, so things like the Microsoft Surface Pro and the iPad Pro. So models, tablet models with detachable keyboards are becoming more and more popular. And as we know, Apple has two great models in their lineup now that fit that category. So that will probably also help kind of level things out in terms of iPad sales decline. Mac sales were also down just slightly, which is another thing we haven't seen in a while, although again, they remain pretty steady. Though this quarter revenue from Macs were down at 9%, coming in at $5.1 billion on sales of about 4 million units, and that's down unit-wise about 12%. Good news is that more than 50% of Mac buyers are new to the Mac, and Apple says 80% of buyers in China are new to the Mac. So Apple continues to sell Macs to new buyers at a pretty good rate, and that always surprises me. That number always seems to hover around 50%. So Apple always finding new buyers for the Mac, which is good for long-term recurring sales. And I think why the Mac has sort of steadily moved along, selling about 4 to 5 million units quarter after quarter. Apple had a little bit of good news when it came to services. Services were actually up. Services revenue came in at just about $6 billion, $5.99 billion, which is more than the revenue now from the Macintosh, if you notice that. Mac was at $5.1 billion, services at $5.9 billion. So those two parts of Apple's businesses are about the same size when it comes to revenue, and that's actually up 20% year over year for services. So Apple's seeing some growth in the services area. Apple's also seeing growth in what is called their other category. If you remember, Apple has combined iPod, Apple Watch, accessories, Beats, and all of that into the other category. That came in at $2.19 billion versus $1.69 billion a year ago, up 30%. And Apple did note during the conference call that's largely thanks to Apple Watch. And they were also quick to point out that Apple Watch has had a customer satisfaction rate. Remember, one of Tim Cook's favorite statistics, customer sat, as he calls it. Customer satisfaction on Apple Watch was at 94%. So those people who are buying Apple Watch are really, really happy with them. Now, before we get too down on these Apple numbers, there was some interesting numbers presented by the San Jose Mercury News from 2015. They publish something called the Silicon Valley 150, a report on the financials of the top 150 companies in the Valley. And Apple was ranked number one, and that's probably not surprising, with 2015 revenue of $234.99 billion. So $235 billion, just call it. So they're at the top of the heap. But what was even more interesting is that that revenue was more than the next four companies on the list combined. Those companies were Alphabet, which is the new parent organization for Google. So Alphabet, Intel, HP Enterprises, and HP. And Apple's profits were more than the next seven companies on that list combined. So, you know, Apple's still doing very, very well when compared to other companies in Silicon Valley. And then Jason Snell, writing for iMore, did some great number crunching looking at Apple's business and what it would look like if they didn't have iPhone. Like, everybody seems to be focused on what's happening with iPhone, and if Apple doesn't have iPhone, Apple is, you know, doomed, is what a lot of people seem to want to report. And you have to remember too, something about this is people have been waiting for Apple to fall for basically 13 years now. They've been sitting at the top. They've got a big target painted on them. So a lot of the reporting, a lot of the analysis that you're seeing right now really is coming about because, one, people wanted Apple to topple. The other thing is that Wall Street and analysts, they don't so much care about profit, you know, how much money a company's making. They want to know about growth. And because this time around, Apple saw a decline in growth, that's a significant impact. And that's why you're seeing the stock take a hit. But I thought it was very interesting. Jason Snell wrote up this piece looking at, okay, so what does Apple's businesses look like without iPhone? And what he found was that Apple's non-iPhone business is generating about $80 billion every year, which is roughly the same amount as Microsoft. And what's interesting about the revenue without iPhone, if you look at their non-iPhone businesses, is that that revenue is very, very stable. It's been very stable over the past 16 quarters, coming in at about right around $19 to $20 billion per quarter. And then plus these four non-iPhone revenue sources. So we're talking about Macs, iPads, other, and services. And you remember other has the Apple Watch in there. Of those four, two of those are actually showing growth. Two of those areas, services and other. Again, it's not as significant as maybe some other pieces of Apple's business in terms of total revenue and total profits generated, but still interesting to look at. And we do have to remember too, both services and other do kind of indirectly rely on iPhone. So even though we're looking at non-iPhone parts of Apple business of Apple's business, almost everything in Apple's business model is touched in some way by iPhone. So iPhone isn't going to go away. There's an iPhone symbiosis with Apple's other products and services, but you know, it's still a pretty healthy business if you take iPhone away. And the point here is that, you know, Apple's product pie chart is going to start shifting away from this total iPhone dominance, I think. It's not just going to be, you know, this large part being iPhone. I think what we're going to see is other parts of Apple's business growing, specifically the services part of that pie, and sort of moving into and filling in the space where iPhone was. Now, again, the concern from Wall Street and from analysts and stuff like that is that still doesn't show growth. What you're seeing is, you know, growth and expansion of one part of Apple's business as another part of Apple's business declines. And so that's not going to generate overall growth. But Apple has more things and kind of coming down the line. And I think in the short term, it is going to level off a little bit. The next couple of years for Apple are not going to look like big growth years. We're going to see some quarters, I would imagine, where there's some decline, some where there's a little bit of growth, but we're not going to see this astronomical growth that Apple's been going through until they launch the next big thing, which is probably 2 to 3 years away, I would imagine. But Apple's revenues are just basically becoming, in my opinion, this more balanced mix. And, you know, that doesn't mean, you know, profit wise, the company is going to be very, very healthy. They're going to be able to continue to run the company. From Wall Street's perspective, it might not be, you know, the golden child anymore, or at least not for the next couple of years, but it should come back around. And Apple's been pretty positive. You know, if you listen to the call, which you can go back and listen to on Apple's website, you'll hear Tim Cook and the executives saying, yeah, we had a rough quarter, but, you know, on the whole, things are looking good for Apple and things are going to go well. And I just want to throw out a plug real quick for Jason Snell. This piece that I found, you know, he wrote up for iMore, but he does his own thing at his Six Colors blog. And he has a ton of really great analysis and a ton of great articles he wrote up this week surrounding Apple's numbers. And if you haven't seen those or haven't read those, certainly take a moment to go over to sixcolors.com and check it out. Finishing up, just a few more notes from the call, a few little odds and ends and things. When looking at iPhone sales, while they were down, Apple said sales were actually up 56% in India, which is a good, important emerging market for them. And they also said that they're seeing more Android switchers moving to iPhone than ever. And Apple's pilfering from Android is interesting to me because while it's driving the average selling price of the iPhone down, likely led by things like the iPhone SE, there are a lot of Android customers that Apple can win over. You have to remember that iPhone only has about 13-14% of the smartphone market. So Android has the vast majority of the customers, and if Apple can start to win some of those customers over to their side, that can certainly slow any kind of iPhone slide and maybe eventually turn it around if they can win enough people over. Now, the danger is with lowering the average selling price to attract those customers, Apple is cutting into the profit margins a little bit. But again, remember, Wall Street likes to see growth. So if Apple just wants to go after growth, they do have an opportunity there. And it'll be interesting to see how they react. I think for the time being, they're going to focus on those markets where they don't have saturation, places like India, and finding other places where they can sell iPhones into and figure out those markets, I think is going to be good for Apple in the long run. You also have the halo effect of services. So we saw services growth in there. Those services can often turn into Mac customers. So you've got Apple Music available for Android users now, and you could see people getting used to using Apple services and then thinking, hey, maybe my next computer is going to be a Mac. So there's some potential benefits for Mac sales as well. Also potential benefit in switching Android users over to the iPhone to sell more Macs and services as well. So all pretty good. And also all smartphone makers, just so you know, are struggling with sales and growth. It's just this general leveling off isn't just happening to Apple. It's happening to the whole smartphone sector as well. So while the numbers seem a little gloomy at first, when you look at the bigger, broader picture, it's maybe not quite as bad. Now, still revenue in China for Apple was down 26%. That's another concern. And it was down 25% in the rest of Asia Pacific. Tim Cook said those are macroeconomic effects that are going on that Apple is feeling and actually other companies are feeling as well. And he was pretty upbeat on it. He thought that things will eventually turn around and it's not going to be a problem moving forward for the long term. That remains to be seen. There's a little debate there, but Tim, again, very positive in the call. Apple Store revenue was up 35%, which is good. And also Apple's cash on hand, their cash hoard, has now grown to $232.9 billion. And speaking of those services that are growing, Apple Music now has 13 million paid subscribers. And while that's not as many as, say, something like Spotify, but what's more important for Apple is Apple has reached 13 million subscribers in just 10 months. So the number of people signing up for and subscribing to Apple Music is actually moving at a very, very fast pace. And if Apple can continue to build on that, again, that's good revenue for Apple's services division, which again is one of its growing segments. And then lastly, numbers that came out from IDC put a little more color on what's happening with the global smartphone market. It basically looks like the top end of the market, again, is leveling out. Apple's seeing a little bit of a drop. IDC noted that Apple lost global market share of about 3% in the quarter. They came in at 15.3%. Samsung was on the top and they lost just 0.1%. So they didn't see as much decline as Apple. But what was more interesting was the companies that seem to be gaining market share in the smartphone space. And that really seems to be the lower priced iPhones like you see in China and Asia, really picking up steam and kind of taking that on. So I think that's why we're seeing Apple move just slightly toward the lower price point segment, the more price sensitive consumers, especially in those regions, to look for a little bit of growth. But again, where they have to be very careful is not competing on going so low that it starts to really impact and affect the average selling price and profits. But I think Apple's going to be very, very careful about that. But still, you know, you can kind of see where smartphones are going. And as we've said over and over, it doesn't appear to be the growth segment, at least for Apple, that it has been. But that's kind of the breakdown of the latest numbers. So not doom and gloom, not great, just kind of moving along. And it might be like that for a little while. So I know that doesn't sound very exciting, right? Well, we need to know is what is the next big thing? And that's what everybody is speculating on. And I think, again, that's part of the problem for analysts is that Apple is so secretive about what they're working on next or what they are going to jump into next that no one really knows. And that gets everybody really nervous, right? Everybody's looking at iPhone saying, okay, this is leveling off. What's Apple going to have coming down the pike that's going to be the big growth segment for them? Services, obviously part of that, but we're looking for something bigger. And only really Apple knows at this point. But I suspect that the most immediate thing, if you just want to know my opinion, is going to be something with augmented reality, probably not pure virtual reality. I'm thinking Apple's going to play more in the space of something like the Microsoft HoloLens. I know VR is kind of getting a hot buzz right now with the, you know, the Samsung product and the Gear VR and also Oculus Rift and all of those things making splashes. But we haven't really seen anything beyond, in my opinion, sort of gaming and toys. We haven't seen sort of the practical applications of that technology. And I think with VR, there are some things in there. Also, artificial intelligence coming into play a little bit there as well. And Apple has been rumored to be working on some of those things. We've talked about some of this in the past. So I think that's going to be the next big segment and product that Apple's going to jump into and disrupt. The question is going to be, when are they going to do that? You know, a lot of people are worried. And this always happens. They worried with the MP3 players that Apple was going to be too late to market. People worried with smartphones that Apple was behind the curve. But what we've seen them do over and over again is wait for the market to get a little bit more mature, not be right on the cutting edge, but then come through with some sort of breakthrough that really makes the technology accessible and approachable to a broad range of consumers, not just early adopters, right? That's one of Apple's strengths is they can show you, hey, here's why you want an MP3 player. The nerds knew they wanted it day one. And that's what's happening, I think, a lot with the VR stuff, right? We're going, wow, this is amazing technology. We're living in the future. We all want it. But the average consumer looks at it and goes, well, that's a toy. I don't really know what to do with that. I get that it's cool for video games and that might be fun for a little bit. But how do I get really, how does this change how I do work? How does this enhance what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis? And we're just not there yet. And I think Apple's looking for that solution. So I see that as being the next big thing. And then after that, I think is when we get into something like the Apple Car. So let's talk a little bit about Apple Car. There was kind of one news story that broke this week related to Apple's rumored Titan Car project. It came from 9to5 Mac. They noticed that Apple had two more key hires from the automotive industry, and both of them were hired for something called the Product Realization Lab, which according to the report is a hardware prototyping lab. Apple hired a former senior CNC programmer for R&D and hardware prototyping at Tesla, David Maciakiewicz, and Kevin Harvey, who was a CNC machine shop supervisor for Andretti Autosports, so Mario Andretti's autosports company. And Harvey actually started, I guess, back in August. Maciakiewicz just left Tesla in March. So Maciakiewicz is a new hire, whereas Harvey has been over at Apple, I guess, for a little while now. And given the skill sets between the two of them, the speculation is it's likely Apple is at a point where they're working on major components for an electric car, or maybe even getting ready to assemble a full prototype. And this could be an indication that they're actually moving away from the early concept phase and prototyping phase and starting to get into some actual designs and actual physical things that they're going to start building. So it'll be interesting to see if we start to see more hires in this area. And I'm sure many of the sites are going to be watching LinkedIn very closely to see what's going on. But that's kind of the latest with Apple's Titan Car project. Moving on to the iPhone 7, again, it continues to look like the rumors are pointing to a new design that is going to ditch the headphone jack. I know that's disconcerting to a lot of you, but get ready for it because it's probably going to happen. We still have the rumors that Apple may be moving to an all-glass design, and that Apple could use an OLED display. That one, the display seems to be a little bit in flux. It still seems like it's probably going to be more like in 2018, and that may be when the major design changes happen as well. Nobody really seems to know. I'm guessing Apple has a couple prototypes floating around, and that's what people are seeing over in the supply chain. But this week, there were supposed leaked schematics on the physical dimensions of the next generation iPhone, the iPhone 7, and they say that they're going to be identical to the existing model, including the thickness. So that would lend itself toward the earlier rumors that Apple's not doing any major design changes for the iPhone 7, at least on the exterior. Although the schematic does show a less pronounced, looks like to me, camera bump on the back, and that is for the dual lens model. The iPhone 7 Plus. Again, it's in flux on whether or not Apple will use the Lynx camera technology, the dual lens camera technology for both models of the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 7 Plus, or just the 7 Plus. More and more, it's seeming like the rumors are pointing toward the dual camera system only being in that higher end model. And the camera module changes should allow Apple to move back to a new flush or at least almost flush design. I would love to see them get rid of the camera bump. I think a lot of people would like to do that. But again, we're seeing some early designs and schematics that seem to indicate that it still will be there just a little bit. There's also rumors that Apple is going to add a 256 gigabyte version of the iPhone and possibly finally drop the 16 gigabyte version on the bottom end. So I would imagine it would wind up being 32 gigs, 128 gigs, and 256 gigabytes if the larger size iPhone does become a reality. We're also hearing rumors that Apple could be looking to go with a fully waterproof and dustproof case. Now, one of the ways they would achieve that would be by eliminating any cracks and seams, entry points, intrusion points. Getting rid of that headphone jack could be one of those tactics. But there's also some kind of sketchy rumors saying that Apple may be developing a touch-sensitive home button that has haptic feedback as the mechanism rather than an actual physical button on the device. We've been hearing about this rumor for a number of years. There's been a lot of speculation that Apple might get rid of the home button. I've always been in the camp that I think the home button is pretty important, not only just from, you know, having a tactile thing there, but also with the Touch ID sensor being in that, I think it'd be difficult to move away from that. But I also think just from an accessibility standpoint, it gives you a point of orientation for the phone. I guess there's other buttons on the phone as well that can help with that. But again, it's just another point. So I didn't see a reason to get rid of it until I actually saw another report that said Apple was granted a patent for a pressure-sensitive liquid metal home button that actually deforms slightly when you press it. So it could be built into the surface completely seamless in metal. And then when you push on it, it deforms, acting like a physical button. But then when you let go, it returns to its normal shape. I kind of think of this as like the Pop-O-Matic home button. So that could be kind of cool. You remember the old, you know, I think it was it Sorry? No, it wasn't the Sorry game. Trouble. The Trouble game that had the Pop-O-Matic bubble, right? Trouble Pop-O-Matic bubble. Oh, I don't know. I'm just showing my age again, which happens from time to time on the show. But you get what I mean. You press this little thing and it pops back up. The same source is also saying that Apple may be considering a new matte black color. And it's not clear if that would replace the space gray with more of a Darth Vader style look, or if it would be in addition to that color. I can't imagine Apple adding a fourth color, so maybe just going darker than the current space gray. There's also some rumors that Apple may move away in this model from the Lightning cable and go with a pure USB-C connector. And I would have immediately dismissed this rumor until this week, because another thing that came out this week was Intel released a spec for doing audio over USB-C, analog audio to headphones. So a little digital to analog converter over USB-C that would allow you to have USB-C based headphones. And if Apple is truly ditching the headphone jack, maybe it's not for a Lightning connector, maybe it's for USB-C. And I think it makes a lot of sense for Apple to standardize on USB-C across the board in all their products and all their devices as the new universal connector. USB-C is the connector that can now support Thunderbolt 3. So you can have Thunderbolt 3, but running over a USB-C connector. It's carrying power. You can do audio over it, video over it. I mean, it seems to be the one port to rule them all, and it would be a great way to go. Could you imagine all of your cables just being one standardized, small, slim connector? Yeah, we're going to have a rough transition period, you know, with adapters and other things for our older devices. But as more and more things move towards USB-C, that pain point will get smaller and smaller. And I think it is a good thing to do maybe moving forward. So I would be happy to see an iPhone with a USB-C connector. Once again, there are a few other rumors going on. Again, we talked about the dual lens camera system, but also that smart connector that we've been talking about as well, that the new next iPhone may get a smart connector, although I'm still a little bit puzzled on exactly what that would be used for. I know a few people like to use keyboards with their iPhone, but it seems like it'd have to be for some other purpose. And if you have any thoughts or theories on what that might be, I'd love to hear from you. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. Now, as far as what the iPhone 7 is going to do for sales, well, KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo is not expecting a whole lot. At least that's what he told his investors. According to Kuo, he said the iPhone 7 is missing, quote, attractive selling points. And then he goes on to diss Apple a little bit, saying that he thinks they're going to be the only top five smartphone vendor in 2017 to actually see their shipments decline. He adjusted his predictions and now says that he expects Apple to sell between 190 and 205 million units in 2016. If that number turns out to be true, that would be an 18% decline from 2015. And his number is also well below general Wall Street consensus right now, which is at 210 to 230 million units for 2016. And citing as, you know, why he thinks it doesn't have attractive selling points, he says, you know, there's no redesign coming, there's increasing competition in the marketplace. And, you know, I'll add, and I don't think he said this directly, but I'll add that, you know, really, the additional features are not compelling enough, I think, to entice people who generally would buy a new iPhone every year to continue in that upgrade cycle. I think there's a lot more people I know who used to buy an iPhone every year. They're looking at the new features and going, you know, I can live without that slightly enhanced processor or the slightly enhanced camera, and I can just wait for that next cycle. So people are just moving into this every other year upgrade cycle, maybe even longer, maybe even into 3 years, and that's affecting Apple's bottom line. So until they have something really, really compelling and a compelling reason to buy a new iPhone, I think that trend is going to continue. And that seems to be what Kuo is alluding to. He said he doesn't expect things to rebound really until 2018, when he thinks Apple is going to do that major redesign. And that's the thing we were talking about earlier, where he thinks Apple's going to go to a dual glass, thinner design, a more radical change. And he's not the only analyst that thinks that. In a note to investors, JP Morgan analyst Mark Moskowitz said that Apple may in the next cycle skip the S naming convention. They may not put out an iPhone 7S. They might jump straight to an iPhone 8. So we'll have iPhone 7 followed by iPhone 8. And he says major form factor changes, including the addition of an OLED display, no home button, and wireless charging would be the reason for that move. So here's a couple of analysts that think those features aren't coming in the iPhone 7, but are going to wait an additional year to come around in the iPhone 8. Now, Apple is not resting on its laurels when it comes to its iPhone. It is trying to do some things to continue to get people to upgrade more frequently. One of those is setting up their payment program. And this week, Apple has extended the iPhone upgrade program to online sales. It used to be to take advantage of that, you know, iPhone for $23 a month upgrade program, you had to go into an Apple retail store or into your carrier store to get that. Now you can do that online. It's limited, though, to the latest models of the iPhone. So you have to be buying an iPhone 6S or a 6S Plus online to take advantage of that. And then one other little iPhone-related thing, story happening over in India. India has apparently passed what's being called a panic button law that would require all phones sold in the country starting in 2017 to have a physical panic button on them. It would need to be a physical button that would call emergency services and give GPS location to authorities and emergency people or personnel when it was pressed on the device. And they say you cannot use a button built into the touch screen for this. So it would likely have to be some sort of new button, dedicated button, or you'd have to use an existing button with some sort of gesture to activate it. And that's probably the route that Apple will end up taking, maybe using the sleep-wake button and something like a triple tap to actually activate the emergency calling feature. And the existing emergency call functionality, if you're thinking about that, where you slide to unlock and then you tap emergency and then you have to type in 911 or an emergency number, that's not enough to comply with this new Indian law. It has to be a physically activated button. So I would expect Apple to tweak something in the software in 2017. And I kind of hope that when they figure this out, they make it a global feature. They don't just restrict it to iOS on iPhones running in India, because I think actually this is a nice little safety feature to have. I would worry a little bit about it being activated accidentally. So there may need to be some mechanisms put in place to try to prevent that situation from happening. But overall, it sounds like a pretty good idea. And that's kind of the latest on iPhones. So the new MacBooks are making their way into the hands of customers as well as the folks over at iFixit. And of course, they did what they always do. They tore into that thing with a vengeance, at least until they reached all of the glue. And a few little tricks on the screws as well, although the screws got a little bit better. Basically, they tore it down. What they found was it has 4% greater battery capacity. It's rated at 41.41 watt hours at 7.56 volts, so up 4% from the prior generation model. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, well, it's got 4% greater battery capacity, but Apple says that thing lasts an hour longer than the old one. Well, that's likely due to the improved energy performance of the Intel Core M Skylake processor that's in the new MacBook. They also noted the 80 to 90% better write performance on the SSD. They say that's due to faster flash technology being in the new MacBook, as well as a new version of Apple's custom controller chip for the storage, which is actually made for them by TSMC. So it's a Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing built chip, but based on Apple's design. And they started doing that with the last MacBook model, but now this has a new upgraded version of that controller. The good news is Apple ditched the custom or unusual tri-wing screws that were in the prior generation MacBook, and they've gone with standard Phillips screws this time around, but they've apparently coated them with some sort of tamper-evident material. So it's a material that once you take the screw out, it brushes away or destroys that material. So Apple will know if you tried to crack into your MacBook. So just be aware of that. You may have trouble getting warranty service after you've broken those tamper-evident screws. But iFixit says, hey, repairability score on this is still at a 1, which is their lowest score. And that's because everything is either soldered in place, including, you know, the RAM and the memory and all that fun stuff. And then the battery and everything else is just glued into place. So continues with, you know, hey, you're not going to fix this thing even if you want to. And even if you did, Apple's going to know that you got in there and they may not honor your warranty at that point. So if you need repairs on it, your best bet's probably going to be take it into an Apple retail store and hand it over to the geniuses. Now, performance-wise, Apple claims that the new MacBook is about 20% faster than the old one, although Geekbench tests are showing that the new Core M Skylake processors are beating out the old Broadcom CPUs by only about 5 to 18%. Now, those tests, of course, are looking at raw CPU, and they don't account for the new graphics processor or the new faster I/O that is in Apple's new MacBook. So that 20% speed increase that Apple's claiming is probably more like real world performance. And so given the processor ratings from Geekbench and the other factors, I would say it's probably on par. So if you're wondering if I get a new MacBook, you know, how much faster it's going to be, 20% is probably a pretty good real world estimate. Now, one odd thing about the MacBook, I think, and several of you have pointed this out, and I always forget this factor, and I don't think I mentioned it in the last show, is that for whatever reason, Apple will not give the thing an HD FaceTime camera. The FaceTime camera in the MacBook is still at 480p. That's some pretty old technology, especially when you consider that every iPhone, and I think even the iPod Touch, has a 720p camera. So I can't imagine that it is a thinness factor. I can only think that maybe it's a cost thing. I don't really know. I'd love to know the background on why Apple hasn't swapped that camera out, but just something to note if you're considering buying that. And then finally, the MacBook's logic board, if you look at the iFixit teardown, that thing is minuscule. It's tiny. And Richard emailed me and pointed out, hey, you know what, Adam? That thing's smaller than a Raspberry Pi. He actually pointed me at an article and they looked at the physical, you know, space on the board. The layout's a little bit different, but it's actually smaller than the Raspberry Pi. Of course, the Raspberry Pi has, many more ports, things like 4 USB and an HDMI port, as opposed to just the single USB-C that's on the MacBook logic board. But it's interesting to think that what if Apple took the MacBook logic board and technology and packaged that into an updated Mac Mini? Maybe something, and Richard coined this phrase, what about a Mac micro computer? Just a little tiny computer, an ultra mini? Maybe that's a better name for it. But it gets really, really interesting because the MacBook is fanless, so you don't have to have the fan in there. Power supply, you know, don't need much power for that low power chip. And it could be really interesting. You would need to, I think, add a couple more USB-C ports and possibly an HDMI port. Or maybe not. You could do, you know, video over the USB-C. But either way, you could wind up with a pretty interesting new little micro mini Mac computer. And I'd kind of like to see what that looks like. So hopefully that's something that Apple is actually playing around with and thinking about. But that's kind of the latest news on the new MacBook. Now let's talk a little bit more about Apple Watch, what's happening with Apple Watch, and what do we expect to see next. Seeking Alpha estimates that Apple has sold between 12 and 13 million Apple Watches in the first year of sales, the first 12 months of sales. And if that's true, they point out that would be double the number of iPhones that were sold in the first year of its sales, which was around 6 million. And Dennis Sellers over at Apple World Today did a little number crunching, and he said, well, if the average selling price of an Apple Watch is around $500, that's about $6 billion in sales. And if you remember, as we were talking about earlier, Apple's other category was up 30% quarter over quarter, and Apple Watch makes up a big part of that. So Apple Watch and accessories is probably where that, you know, where the bulk of that other category revenue is coming from. And that makes sense given some of these estimates on numbers. So Apple Watch sales doing really well, and they've been doing even better more recently because of the US $50 price drop, at least according to the latest report from Slice Intelligence. They think that that price drop may have helped Apple increase sales of the Apple Watch by about 250% over the last month. And they also claim that the new nylon woven bands, according to their numbers, seem to be accounting for about 60% of the first party accessory sales that Apple is seeing at retail. So those two things are, again, bringing up that other number in Apple's category there. And so while Apple seems to be increasing the number of Apple Watches they're selling, overall, their share of the global smartwatch market actually dropped 9%, according to Strategy Analytics. They say that Apple came in this last round at 52%. That was versus 63% market share last quarter. So, not an insignificant loss, but Apple probably still shipped about 2.2 million Apple Watches, according to the report. Overall, the smartwatch segment grew 223%. So seeing massive growth, and I'm guessing why Apple's share is down a little bit is more likely due to the success of the Apple Watch than anything else. Apple is a victim of the Apple Watch's own success because it really raised interest in the smartwatch platform. And I think that brought a lot more customers to market. A lot of them are buying Apple Watches, but a lot of them maybe can't afford an Apple Watch or want something that works a little bit better with their Android device. And so they're looking at Android Wear or some other product. And that means Apple's not getting that sale. So, of course, the market's growing. Apple's seeing a little shrinking of their segment of the market, but overall, the whole thing's growing for everybody. So what's the phrase? How does that go? Rising tide raises all ships. So that's what's happening there. And then as far as what's happening with Apple Watch 2, we got some exciting news via the Wall Street Journal this week. They ran a piece saying that they had a source who was telling them that Apple is planning on adding more autonomy to the next version of the Apple Watch. Their source told them that Apple plans to add cellular connectivity to the Apple Watch, breaking its bond and reliance on the iPhone. This was something that a lot of people pointed at day one as being a limitation and really an Achilles heel of the Apple Watch, its heavy dependence on the iPhone. What they don't address in the report, though, is how is Apple going to manage and handle data plans and rates from carriers? How would all of that work? I would assume that it would work currently sort of like iPads do, with an add-on price and shared data plans. Now, would it be $10 a month to add an Apple Watch to your plan? I think it likely could be. Some people have said they think that's too much, but I think for those people who really want that feature, they're probably willing to pay for it. Another thing I didn't see in the report was there didn't seem to be a mention of GPS, but I assume that would also be included with the cellular modem. Most of Apple's devices, that's all in a single chip. So if Apple can add GPS and cellular, I think that would be a huge win for the Apple Watch 2. The other question would be, will the cellular features be an add-on or an add-on to the price point like it is with iPads? So you can get the Apple Watch with Wi-Fi or the Apple Watch plus cellular for a little bit more. I think Apple would go with the latter, but maybe to simplify things, you will only have one option. And, you know, as far as how it will work, will it have a SIM card slot like a nano SIM, or will it use an eSIM? So there's a lot of things to think about when you're thinking about a cellular based watch. Probably the most important one being, how are you going to handle battery life? I mean, the Apple Watch already kind of gets slammed a little bit for its battery life. Apple certainly couldn't go down if they're adding this functionality. They would need to either stay the same or go up. I don't know if they can do some creative things with toggling the cellular on and off when you need it and when you don't. But when I think about that, I think about how long it takes my iPhone to acquire a signal. And also, you know that that is a number one battery drain. Every time you're trying to acquire a new cellular signal, it ramps up the antennas and stuff like that, which really eats into the power. So Apple will have some technical challenges to overcome, but if they can pull it off, I think that would be huge for Apple Watch. Other rumors we've heard surrounding Apple Watch 2 is that it may have a FaceTime camera, another great feature that would really be enhanced if you had cellular capability built into your Apple Watch. And we've also heard rumors of a design that would be 20 to 40% thinner. I think we've talked about that in the past. Although if Apple is going with cellular, I think that would really call into question that rumor. I think Apple would have a hard time making the watch thinner and adding the cellular connectivity without impacting battery life. And the Wall Street Journal piece claims that all of the designs for the Apple Watch 2 would remain largely the same. So there wouldn't be a lot of external changes, and that seems to make more sense. Of course, the Apple Watch 2 would also have Apple's next generation chip in it, currently called the S1, S meaning system on a chip or system in a package, however you want to call that. SIP, I think, is actually the correct term, system in a package. The new one would be, by token, called the S2, and would reportedly be faster. Surprise, surprise. So new processor. And some other rumors pointing to maybe the Apple Watch getting a little bit more autonomy is Apple has said that starting in June 1st, as a matter of fact, developers are only going to be able to submit Apple Watch apps that run natively on the Apple Watch. So you can no longer have them running on the phone and then sort of, you know, broadcasting the data to the Apple Watch screen. They have to be installed and run native on the watch using Watch OS 2 framework. That would mean, I would assume, that we should see a little bit better performance, although I think I have some native watch apps on my watch and they're still a little bit slow. So it'll be nice to see an Apple Watch 2 with maybe a little more performance and a better processor to handle some of those natively running apps. But we should get a glimpse of Watch OS 3 at WWDC in June and a little more information on what's happening on that front. So that's what we can expect from the next generation of Apple Watch. A few other stories related to current Apple Watch. Good news for those of you in Australia, at least if you're a customer of ANZ Bank. It now seems that you can register your Visa and American Express cards with Apple Pay, and you'll start to be able to use Apple Pay in Australia. Hopefully more banks down under will follow suit and bring Apple Pay support. Now that you have one bank, it typically follows that the other ones will try and jump on board relatively quickly. But at least this week, ANZ Bank in Australia is supporting Apple Pay. And then we are hearing rumors that Apple's next partner for a premium set of watch straps, like the Hermes straps, is going to be the leather company Coach. They are reportedly working on at least 8 bands in different colors, white, black, red, and brown leather. Some of them with stitching in the designs, some of them having little charms on them. And they will reportedly be priced at around $150 US and will be made available around WWDC. If you remember when Apple brought out this latest round of watch bands, the nylon straps and things, they announced it as their spring collection. So I'm now wondering, is the Coach set of bands going to be part of Apple's summer collection? I think that's very likely and probably something we'll hear mentioned or at least talked about at WWDC. But that's the latest stories with Apple Watch. And then finally in the news for this week, a couple quick things on Apple and the FBI. There is a White House group, apparently, that reviews flaws discovered by the U.S. government in technology and decides whether or not those flaws and vulnerabilities should be shared with the public and the companies that make those products. So this is a commission that many are hoping will take a look at the San Bernardino FBI hack and maybe turn that information over to Apple. But the FBI is claiming that the method they used for unlocking that phone may not even qualify to be submitted for review. And they're saying that's because they actually purchased the hardware and software from a third party, somebody who we don't know who that is, and the FBI isn't saying, but the FBI is implying that they don't even know the specific technique that was used, that they weren't told, they didn't know, and so therefore they can't pass along that information. And then remember that story that was floating around based on some statements made by FBI Director James Comey saying that the FBI spent $1.3 million on the iPhone hack in that case. And it was based on the statement that he said it cost more than the remaining amount, I think, of his salary for his time at the FBI. And some people did some on the back of a napkin math and came out with the $1.3 million figure. And remember how I said when I talked about it that I thought the FBI would would come out and respond and basically deny that it cost them that much. Well, that didn't happen immediately, but it did happen this week. They came out and said they did not spend more than $1 million on that hack. They did not give an actual figure, so we still don't know what it is, but it wasn't over $1 million. So there you have it. That is the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is iMazing. Hey, if you have an iPhone or an iPad, this is a tool that you're going to want to look into, and you're probably going to want to have a copy of, because what it allows you to do is directly access and manage and work with the data that is on your iOS devices. Not only that, it brings some additional features and functionality that are really, really helpful, especially when it comes to backing up data, saving data, and those sorts of things. So you can manage your iTunes files directly and get iTunes data on and off, all with no jailbreaking required. You can manage and interact with data from your messages, from your photos, your videos, the music apps, notes, contacts, voicemail, call history, even the file system. You can get at files that are inside individual gaming applications or applications that you use. I've used the tool to actually get at data that's in things like Paper by 53 so that I can back up some of my illustrations and things that I have in there. And it uses a very familiar Apple-like interface that really makes it easy to work within the application. And when you're moving data back and forth directly in the app, it works asynchronously, so you don't have to wait. You can start one thing going in the background and move on and work on another part of your iOS device. And you can even access and browse files that are inside your backup files. So this, again, is great for recovering individual app data for apps that maybe don't store that in the cloud. How many times have you found that you have to do a full erase and reinstall of your iOS device, and then you find out, oh, I put the app back on and all of my app data is gone. Now you could use iMazing to go back, grab that data, and copy it back into the appropriate location for that app on your iOS device and get all of your data back. It's a great way also to back up and save things like your messages and your voicemails. So if you want to clean that stuff off your phone, but you want to maintain an archive of it, you can open up iMazing, copy that all over to your Mac, save it off, and then delete it so that you have an ongoing record of all of your voicemails and your messages. It does that stuff and a whole lot more. And best of all, you can try it out completely free. And when you decide to order iMazing, and I know you're going to want to get it, you can get 20% off if you use the coupon code MACCAST. So check it out, iMazing.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MACCAST. So last week we were talking about the iPhone 7, and one of the big rumored features is that it may bring wireless charging. And I talked about the fact that I'm really not that excited about wireless charging because I don't think it brings enough advantages versus maybe some of the disadvantages. And I threw it out to you. I said, hey, what do you think about wireless charging? Is this something you want? And Michael emailed me back and he said, yeah, this is something I want. And he pointed out kind of two scenarios where he sees a real benefit to wireless charging. The first one being bedside or overnight charging, the ability to just have a charging pad right there next to your bedside. You come home, take your iPhone out of your pocket or your purse, you throw it on the charging pad and go to sleep. And then when you wake up, it's charged. You don't have to connect or plug in a cable. And then also same kind of scenario inside the car, as more and more cars have in-dash entertainment systems with CarPlay support or integration with the iPhone and Bluetooth. It'd be nice if you can just throw it into a center console or a cubby that would have a wireless charging mechanism built into it. And then you'd be able to charge in the car and use your device as you know, hands-free while you're driving. And it would be a lot more convenient in that scenario. And again, I think I get it. I understand that we're adding a little bit of convenience, but at what cost and what are the potential disadvantages to gain that little bit of convenience? And I know little conveniences are the things that make life enjoyable, right? But literally, it takes less than a half a second, I think, to plug in a cable versus setting something down on a wireless charging pad. You still have to go to a specific location. You still have to have a cable plugged into a wall outlet that's attached to something that your device is actually going to connect to. Because while I get I don't have to plug in a physical connection with my Apple Watch, I still have to set it on the little magnetic thing. So it's really not all that different than plugging in a cable. And so what is the disadvantage, though, of wireless charging? And I talked about this last week. I think the main disadvantage is that you can't use your device while it's plugged in. And if you go traveling, you go to an airport, you go to a hotel lobby, and you look and you see what people are doing, many people are plugging in their iPhones, they're charging them, and they're using them at the same time. With a wireless charging pad, you're gonna lift it off the pad, you're gonna break that connection. And yes, you maybe could do some creative magnetic thing to stick it on there, but again, then what are you doing? You've basically recreated the same thing you would have done if you actually plugged in the device. And a lot of people will argue, well, Adam, you could have both. You could have wireless charging and you could have, you know, the lightning port still there. You're still going to need the lightning port for syncing data, for example. And that's another one of my points, is that now you've got redundant functionality. You've got two things that do exactly the same thing, and that's a waste of space. You've got to have extra components and things inside the device. That space you're going to take away from maybe something more important, like a larger battery. And I really just don't see the advantage. I get that we as human beings are inherently lazy, and if we can save the 0.5 seconds of time of plugging something in, that is something that we're going to want. And here's the deal. Ultimately, I'm totally wrong. I am wrong about this. I'll tell you right up front. These are my opinions. I don't see the benefit or the need for wireless charging, but apparently I am completely wrong, because I read a survey recently and it said something like 56% of people said that wireless charging was the number one feature they wanted to see in the next version of the iPhone. So majority says this is a feature you want, and it's very likely, I think, a feature that Apple is going to deliver. But for me, I think until we have true wireless charging, charging at a distance, which is possible, you know, go look at some of the work that Tesla was working on way back when, and you can see this is technology that can happen. There's some interesting companies actually making this technology work. It's not there at a consumer level yet, but in the lab, yes, there is true wireless charging. Frankly, it scares me a little bit, you know, to think more sort of radio waves coming our direction, but hey, it's something that could happen. But until that happens, I don't get the sort of fascination beyond, hey, this is a cool technology with wireless charging. Hey, that's just me. And again, I'd still love to hear your thoughts and opinions on this. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I've got a couple listeners who emailed me this week. They're looking for help. I tried to help them the best that I can. That's what I will always do if you email me. But oftentimes, guess what? I get stumped myself. And so that's when I throw it out to you, the community, and say, hey, we need a little bit of help here. So George emailed me. He's looking for a cheaper alternative to heart rate monitoring than an Apple Watch. So he'd like to get an Apple Watch, but it's a little on the higher end of a price range for him. But he wants to have continuous heart rate monitoring. And while George found and I found monitors from companies like Polaris and Garmin and a few others, you also have fitness bands like the Fitbit. What we're finding is that while they can do heart rate monitoring, they don't offer all of the features that the Apple Watch does when it comes to heart rate. And specifically what George is looking for is a device that can do quote unquote continuous monitoring. So basically regular monitoring. I think the iPhone does it at 5 minute intervals when you're not actually in activity or workout mode. Just when you're walking around, every 5 minutes, it kind of takes a heart rate and then puts that into the health app via HealthKit. And that's the second thing he's looking for. He wants something that's going to integrate with the health app and the HealthKit data, and something that has good data protection and privacy. These are all things that the Apple Watch brings. And in looking at, you know, the Garmins and the Polaris's and the Fitbits and the other exercise bands, even like the Microsoft band, I'm not seeing all of these features get hit. And so I was having trouble finding anything to recommend to George. The Fitbit seems to be the closest thing that I can find. I'm not sure about their, you know, their privacy and security area, but you do need to seem to have a third-party app if you want to sync Fitbit data to HealthKit. It does not have direct integration with HealthKit. And again, I don't know that it has continuous heart rate monitoring. You may need to be in an exercise mode before it does that. Now, the Microsoft Band also seems to be a possible option, but it still doesn't have HealthKit integration, at least as near as I can tell. They announced that they would add HealthKit integration, but it hasn't come out yet. And the other thing about the Microsoft Band is it looks like the price point is US$249, which is now only $100 less than a full-blown Apple Watch, a 38-millimeter Apple Watch. So I think if you're going to spend $249, why not spend the extra $100 and get the additional functionality and app support and integration that the Apple Watch supports versus something like the Microsoft Band. The Microsoft Band looks great. It looks like a great product. But again, for my $100 more, I'd rather just get, you know, the integration. And George, that's what I would think about in looking at that product. So here's the call to the community. Do you have a product suggestion or a viable solution for George that's going to solve all these problems? Now, again, just to recap, what he's looking for is something that is cheaper than an Apple Watch, will allow him to do continuous heart rate monitoring, have integration with the health app on his iPhone and HealthKit, and has good data protection and privacy. If you can find something that has all of that, that isn't an Apple Watch and comes in at about, you know, $100 to $150 price point, let us know about it, maccast@gmail.com. And then this isn't so much a call for help as it is a a groan of frustration. Maybe that's the best way to put it. Greg told me about something that I had missed in the latest fourth generation Apple TV update. And now actually I'm kind of pissed after he told me. So what he found out was that, you know, the fourth generation, or I guess it was really the iOS update to the fourth generation Apple TV that brought support for Siri dictation for text boxes. So you now know on the Apple TV with the Siri remote, you can dictate into a text box, and that includes password boxes. But what Greg discovered was that now the remote app on your iPhone, which you can use to control your Apple TV, no longer brings up the keyboard when you access a login box, at least for iCloud or iTunes. And I verified this on my own Apple TV. You now go in there and the keyboard doesn't come up. And the problem with that is that that now means you cannot copy and paste from a password management app on your iOS device like 1Password. There's no way to copy your complex password in there. So the only way to get it in is now to dictate it in, which means you're going to be reading your password out loud while you sit there in your living room. So you hope that, you know, no one's around to steal your password. And I don't know if I'm hoping this is just a bug and something that Apple addresses, but I guess the call for help would be if anybody knows a workaround for this, or maybe there's some little trick that we're missing to actually get the keyboard to slide up in this scenario, let us know about it, maccast@gmail.com. But otherwise, I think I'm going to be filing a bug report with Apple, and maybe all of us should do that for this missing feature. Next up, Bob wrote in to warn us all about a phishing scam he received via email. And I guess maybe I should jump back a little bit. I assume everybody in this day and age knows what phishing is, and that's P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G. Phishing is when you receive an email that basically looks like it's coming from maybe your bank or from Apple or from Google, somebody that you do business with. But what it's really doing is trying to probe and grab your personal information. So they'll say something like, critical warning with your bank account. Please click here to verify your account information. And you click on there and then you go end up on a site that looks like Chase Bank, but really isn't Chase Bank. And you end up putting in a bunch of your personal information and then they steal your identity. So that's phishing. So Bob got one of these emails. And in this case, he had an email that looked like it was from Apple regarding his iTunes account. And it was asking him to click a link and to verify his account information. And basically what they're going to try and do is they're going to try and steal your email and your credit card number and your password and all of that stuff. So don't click on those things. And what I just wanted to say is that while, you know, the one that Bob is warning us about is a specific one that looks like an Apple email, these things come out all the time. So the fact that you got one, Bob, is just a matter of timing. I get them, I've received them, you know, I probably receive a couple a month if I'm going through my email. And, you know, they look like emails from not just Apple, but it could be Amazon, Google, Facebook, your bank. I mean, they're constantly trying to get at us with these things. And here's the thing. You know, I figure what we should do is maybe cover the general topic of, you know, how do you identify these phishing scams? What can you do to protect yourself from getting hit by them? You know, what are some of the precautions that you should take? So none of these services, you know, the first thing to know about emails, if you do business with Google or Amazon or Facebook, none of these companies are ever going to send you an email asking you to provide personal details about your account via email. They may contact you a different way, but it's not going to come in an email saying, click this link and go to this form on a web page and give us your credit card number and your social security number and your email address and your driver's license number and all of that stuff. The minute you see an email telling you that, assume it's a scam. And then check directly with the company that you're getting it from. Call up Apple support or call up Amazon support and say, hey, I got this email. Is this really you guys? That's probably the number one way to protect yourself. Just double check or go directly to the website. But absolutely never click on the links in the emails. And use your, I think one thing that a lot of people don't do is just use their, you know, their spider sense, basically your common sense. If you see an email and it seems fishy, it probably is fishy with a PH. It probably is a phishing email. And, you know, you're right to be leery of it. So, you know, trust your gut, trust your instincts. So if you want to do a little more digging, you know, what can you do to kind of verify, hey, this is a phishing email and really identify it? One simple thing is read all the text of the email. I know a lot of us don't read all of our, you know, email text these days, but read all the text because a lot of these scams come from foreign countries. And often they will have very glaring spelling mistakes or grammar mistakes. And again, a professional company like Apple is not going, they're going to proofread their stuff before they send it out to you. They're not going to have weird spelling mistakes in it. So that's flag number one. Number two thing you can do is you can hover over the link if you're on your Mac or if you're on your iOS device, just long press on the link. Now, don't click on it. And also, if you're on an iPhone that has force touch support, don't force press on the link. Just press and hold on the link. Don't click. And what you'll get is you'll get a pop-up. You'll get a tooltip that will actually reveal the actual link under, you know, the URL that's underlying that link. Look at that, and it will often reveal a destination that's like a weird IP address or some weird foreign website. You can usually identify and tell, oh, hey, this is not coming from apple.com. This is coming from applephishing.com, and don't click on it. So be very careful when you're doing this. Don't click on it. And one thing to know about maybe legitimate emails, if you subscribe to a newsletter or something like that, sometimes you'll think it's a phishing scam. You click on it, you see the URL, and it can be misleading because the email might be, the link might be redirected through the email sending service for tracking purposes. So MailChimp is a common example of this. You get it, or Constant Contact, you get an email that comes via, you know, some company via MailChimp. Look at the link and it's going to go to MailChimp first and then redirect you back to the corporate website. And those are legitimate links. But the bottom line is if you're at all suspicious about the link, do not click on it. Now, if you think the email might be valid, but you're really not sure, you're still leery of the link in there, again, what I advised earlier, just open up your browser and type the company's website URL directly into the URL box. You know, don't copy and paste the link from the email, but literally if it's an Apple email, type in apple.com and then go to Apple's support page or the press release page or something like that. If, you know, it's the kind of thing where they're saying, hey, your iCloud, you know, iCloud got hacked and we're asking you to change your password. Apple is going to put out a news release on their website saying, hey, iCloud got hacked. We're telling people to reset their password, or better yet, just log into iCloud.com directly. Again, go to iCloud.com, log in, and there's going to be a notice right there on the site if it is real. You don't need to click the link in the email. So that's another way that you can protect yourself. And then another way to check an email is to look at the from address. And you can click on the from address and then see the underlying email address that it came from. And if it doesn't say apple.com, then, you know, your flags should go up. Now, no, most of the time, if they're a smart, you know, hacker, someone who's doing the phishing, they're going to actually spoof that from address. So it'll still say from info@apple.com or something like that, but the links will still go someplace else. So they'll try and hide themselves there. So that's not always the best one, but it is just another place that you can check. And then also in mail with the message open, you can look at the mail headers. You can actually look at the path that that email took to get to you through the internet. So you can kind of backtrace it to the source. So if you go under the view menu and then select message and then all headers, you can see all that stuff. Now, again, it looks a little bit cryptic. It's like reading log files, so it's a little bit intimidating to some people. But again, if you're suspecting an email of being phishing, you can kind of track it down that way. And then if all of this, you know, is sort of going over your head or you're just not really sure, Apple does have a great support page. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, and it covers ways for helping you identify phishing emails, and also gives you a link where you can actually report to Apple, hey, I got this phishing email, it says it's from you, and let Apple know about it so that they can pursue maybe legal or other mechanisms to kind of get that stuff stopped. So that's a good way to do that. So that's, you know, phishing in a nutshell. A couple other things that I want to talk about related to this, you know, tips for actually stopping phishing on the web, because phishing not only happens with email, but if you've ever gone to some websites, occasionally you'll get a pop-up, you'll get something that says, hey, we've detected that your computer's been hacked. Click here to download our software and we'll remove the virus for you. Yeah, that's a scam, right? They're trying to get you to click on something, download a Trojan, run it on your thing, and then they're going to load up your computer with adware or malware. So a couple ways you can protect yourself on the web. One, you know, if you see one of those, run away quickly, quit your browser, go away. I know a lot of us now have it set up so that when you reopen your browser, it opens up all the windows, and a lot of times all those pop-up windows can come back. A trick you can use on Safari is if you hold down the Option key while you quit Safari, or, you know, choose Option quit, then it will actually close any open windows or pop-ups or things. It'll shut all those back down. If you shut down quickly and you've forgotten to do that, if you hold down Option Shift while you open up Safari, it will open up to a blank Safari window. It won't have any of the previous, you know, windows or anything open. So that's how you can kind of reset things. But also in Safari, make sure you're using your pop-up blocker, and maybe even consider using an ad blocker, and then whitelist just the legitimate sites that you wish to support. So if you're worried, you know, I don't want to use an ad blocker because I go to these websites, these news websites, and I want them to get the revenue, you know, for the content that they're producing, just go ahead and whitelist those sites. But having your pop-up blockers or your ad blockers can actually protect you from some of this online phishing scams and pop-ups and things like that. So that's another little trick. Another thing that I'm surprised a lot of people don't do, and I wish Apple would have this turned on by default, I don't think they do, is make sure in Safari that you're using the status bar. So that's the thing that in Safari, when you hover over a link, it shows you the actual URL down at the bottom of the browser window. So under the view menu, make sure you've got show status bar turned on. If you go under the view menu and it says hide status bar, then you know the status bar is turned on. And anytime you're going to go click on a link, make sure you do that. If you run across short links, often a good thing to do is just do a Google search for, you know, short link expander. There's online expanders that you can do. You can copy that short link and paste it into one of those tools, and you can actually see the full URL before you click on it, because sometimes those are used to mask or hide what people are doing. So that's another thing to check out. I think some obvious ones, you know, be careful about the websites that you're going to visit. Avoid downloading any pirated apps or movies or anything from torrents. Oftentimes, you know, you think you're getting some free application, but what you're really ending up with along with it is some sort of Trojan that's going to infect your Mac either with a virus or more typically now adware or some other kind of malware. And then two, I think I probably should mention that even if you're going to a site that you've always visited and one that you trust, you can sometimes get these pop-ups. And I've seen it happen a couple different ways. The number one way is the site that you're visiting itself has been hacked, and maybe the site owner doesn't even know it. You know, somebody got in there and they installed some malware on the site, and now they're trying to run a phishing scam or some other scam against that site and catch those site users. So that can happen. I've also seen it come through some of the ad networks. Every once in a while, something will slip through a legitimate ad network, and the ads on the website will start popping up those sorts of, you know, offers and things like that. And that's another one of these areas where using an ad blocker might be able to benefit you. But just be aware, you know, if you see this stuff, run away. That's my number one recommendation to people. You know, close your browser, close all the windows, just get away from that thing as fast as possible and start over. And then finally, I guess the thing to cover is what happens if you actually get hit by a piece of malware. It happens. I've been, you know, a number of my clients have called me up recently and said, hey, my Mac is running slow. What's going on? I'm getting all these weird pop-ups when I'm browsing the web. All these ads are popping up. I don't know why. That's typically a sign that somehow you got hit by malware. And don't feel bad. It happens to everybody. You know, it's just one of the things of the world we live in. The key is don't panic, and there's some pretty simple ways to actually remove that stuff. So one way of knowing that you've been hit by malware or adware is, again, you're seeing strange ads and pop-ups showing up on sites that you normally visit where that stuff wouldn't normally be. If it looks odd, something might be odd. And if you're seeing beach balling or it feels like your Mac is running sluggish, you can look at Activity Monitor. There might be background processes related to this stuff running that's, you know, messing things up. You can identify it that way. But really the easiest way to do it is if you suspect it at all, there's a great piece of software called Malwarebytes. It's free. It's awesome. It was formerly called Adware Medic. And you can download it. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. Just run this. It will identify any malware or adware that might be running on your computer and offer to clean it up for you. And you can select the stuff that you want and get it off of there. Just some common ones that you'll run across and apps to avoid in general. Mac Keeper. That stuff is nasty. Stay away from it. Genio, something called OneSearch or vSearch. This is a new one for me, but one of my clients had this. And basically what was happening is every time he would do a search in Safari, it would actually go to this OneSearch site instead of going to Google. So they were like rerouting all of his search traffic through their system. And I think the idea was is that they were trying to basically hijack search revenue. It was really weird, but then it would dump him back onto Bing. So it would kind of filter through their search thing and then flip him around and throw him back on Bing. So it was trying to kind of hide itself. And then flash installers. Avoid flash installers like the plague unless you're getting it directly from Adobe's website. But in general, I would just say you really don't need flash much anymore. And if you do have a few sites that do require flash, consider downloading and just using Chrome as an alternative browser, because Chrome has a sandboxed version of flash baked right into it. So you can just use it within Chrome and you don't have to worry about flash or anything else getting out and affecting the rest of your system. And absolutely never, never install flash when prompted to randomly from a website. So you go to a website and says, oh, you need flash to view this website, update it. Sometimes that actually is Adobe alerting you, but you really don't know. It could be someone trying to phish you. So if you see that and you think you need an updated copy of flash, again, use the trick I mentioned earlier. Just type, you know, open up a new browser window, type adobe.com, go to their flash section and make sure you're getting it directly from the source. And that's going to help keep you better protected. So there you go. Some tips and tricks on dealing with phishing and malware. I received a couple of questions this week related to Apple products and, you know, maybe some ways on saving a little bit of money. I think it's really easy to get excited. I know I'm very guilty of this. It's very easy to get excited when a new Apple product comes out. Like, you know, right now, what am I kind of lusting after? Oh, I'm lusting really after one of those new nylon bands. But do I really need it? No, I really don't need it. It's just something I want. But, you know, we all fall into this hype. We're nerds, we're geeks, we're Apple lovers. We kind of want everything that Apple puts out. And so I got a couple of questions this week about, you know, how can I save money? What are ways that I can, you know, maybe get the products I want, but not spend so much on them? And one of those ways is buying refurbished products. But Ron emailed me and he said, you know, I want to get an older iPhone. I want to get an iPhone 5C. I need to get it unlocked. It's actually for a relative. We don't want to spend a lot of money on it. A 5C would be great, but I'm having a hard time finding one because Apple no longer sells them. So how can I get one? And my immediate thought was, well, Gazelle. You know, Gazelle's a sponsor here on the MacCast, but part of what they do is they have a great store. So when you sell something back to Gazelle, what they do is they take it in, they look at it. If it's still a usable product, they will refurbish it, wipe it clean, and then basically reuse it. They'll resell it back into the marketplace at a lower cost. So if you go to buy.gazelle.com, you can look through their products, but they don't have any iPhone 6Cs. They have 5s and 5Ss and other models, but they don't have a 6C. Now, there are other resellers that do similar things, Amazon, eBay. If you just Google, you know, refurbished iPhone 5C unlocked or something like that, you can find those devices out there. At that point, it's like, who do you trust? I mean, a lot of these companies are companies that I've never heard of, so I don't really know. So if you have found a good source for refurbished or used devices, specifically iPhones, that's not Apple, let us know about that. But, you know, those are the only places that I can think of specifically for iPhones. But then Gary sent in a voicemail to me asking, you know, Apple runs these, you know, recycling programs, buyback programs as well. What do they do with all the iPhones? Because they're obviously not reselling them. Like I said, you can't go buy a refurbished iPhone like you can buy a refurbished Mac. And I've often said on the show, you know, look at Apple's used or refurbished store when you go to buy a new Mac, and you'd be surprised at the kind of deals that you can find. You can save several hundred dollars buying a refurbished Mac. And they come with the same standard AppleCare warranty, and you can buy additional AppleCare warranties with them. And I personally feel that they're even probably better than new, because Apple's going to take those machines in. Typically what's happening is they're taking in a machine that's come in for replacement. They replace it for a customer with a new one, and then they take it back to their facilities. They open it up, they look at all the components, they analyze everything and go, oh, well, you know, this one just has a failed hard drive. Well, we'll take this perfectly good machine, put a new hard drive in it, retest everything, and then we'll sell it back as refurbished. And so they've gone over, you know, basically with a fine-tooth comb, everything that's in that product. And that doesn't happen when they're coming out of the factory, right? They're only testing, you know, every 1,000 units or something, you know, one unit in every 1,000, or probably even less than that. So refurbished, I think, is a great way to go. But for whatever reason, Apple does not resell refurbished iPhones, at least not here in the U.S. We did get that story that Apple does want to sell them maybe into India. So maybe they're going into other markets that Apple sells into that are a little more price sensitive. But Gary also mentioned the recycling story from a couple of weeks ago. He says, you know, if they're not reselling them, are they tearing them apart and recycling them? Remember, you know, there was that report that Apple recovered $40 million worth of gold from iPhones. And I'm guessing that when, Gary, you sent that email, you hadn't heard last week's episode yet, because I covered that specifically. Apple actually isn't getting almost any revenue from any of their recycling efforts. Go back and listen to that episode and you'll find out why. But, you know, Apple does seem to be maybe selling them overseas to sell into these other markets. Maybe they are using some of them for parts. And I do think that some of them do get recycled. So if they're damaged or can't be repurposed or refreshed, I do think Apple recycles them. But I think that's what's going on. But as far as, again, saving money on your own Apple devices, you know, one thing that you can do is, do your own refurbishing or reuse. You know, in my family, we hand down our old devices either, you know, internally to direct family members or to friends or somebody like that, so that they can be reused so they can save money. I know, so I'm not buying new devices for every member of my family. Those are getting rolled down because the devices are still good. I'm getting a new device every year, and I know a lot of you do this as well. So that's one way to go to save money. As far as prepping an old device to maybe give away to somebody, I thought I'd give you a little tips on doing that. Backup or archive, of course, any content that you want to keep from that device. So plug it into iTunes, run a backup, you know, pull your photos off, pull any old text messages, use something like iMazing to grab the data off your device if you want to do that. Then make sure you log into iTunes, log out of iTunes, log out of iCloud, turn off Find My iPhone so that you don't have any device lock problems, do all those sorts of things. And then you can erase the device. So if it's your Mac, you can run the OS X installer, you know, boot up holding down the recovery key, the R key, and then when the installer comes up, you can go into the utilities, use disk utility to actually erase the drive and then install a clean copy of the operating system onto the Mac before you give it away. Or you can, if you have an iOS device, of course, attach it into iTunes, do a restore, and then set the device up as new. And as a matter of fact, after I do the restore, I don't even set it up. I just let it go to the point where, you know, it would be ready to be set up. I think it says on the screen, you know, swipe to set up. Just leave it in that state. And then when you give it to the new person, it's like they just got a new iPhone out of the box. They'll either swipe to start the setup process, or they can plug it into iTunes and start setting it up as well. So hand down those old devices is one way to, you know, continue the longevity. Internally, maybe find a new purpose for that old device. I have an old Mac Mini that is a Core Duo Mac Mini, the original, not a Core 2 Duo, and it's like a 2006 Mac Mini. It even only runs OS X Snow Leopard. And I've repurposed it as a file server. I use it as a backup server. You can use those things as media servers. You can use old iPhones as web cameras and security cameras or weather stations, or, you know, use an old iPad just as a picture frame. It's got that, you know, it's got great software you can find for running slideshows and picture frames and things like that. You know, put it in a nice frame and actually turn it into something. There's all kinds of uses. And even if it's a broken device, you know, you can use an old Mac case as household items. There's all kinds of stuff. Do some Googling on, you know, sort of upcycling old Macs, and you'll find all kinds of uses. Remember the Macquarium project? You can turn your old Mac into an aquarium or a lamp, or I've even seen, you know, old Macs turned into furniture. So lots of great ways to kind of reuse and repurpose your old Macs. And then, you know, another tip is finding ways to get by with what you already own and making it last a little bit longer. So this is more about kind of extending the dollars you spend on your Mac products. So maybe think about not upgrading every year. Maybe you know, extend it to every 18 months or 24 months on an iPhone or an iPad. Or maybe with your Mac, you eke out an extra year of functionality out of it. So while, you know, maybe in year 3 or 2, you're feeling like, hey, I really want to replace this thing, consider trying to use it a little bit longer and see if you can't optimize it. You know, clean off the hard drive space. Maybe go in and replace a hard drive with an SSD. You know, spend a couple $100 to just refurbish it. And that could be an internal or an external SSD. That really will extend the life of a computer for an extra couple years. So consider doing that. And what's nice about keeping our products a little bit longer is that means that fewer devices are ending up in the landfill or ending up being recycled or something like that. And that's ultimately good for the environment. So if we can use our things a little bit longer, you know, that's a good idea as well. And so there's lots of ways we can kind of think about this and maybe save a little bit money and, you know, benefit our friends and family and maybe even the environment a little bit. And I thought that was well worth talking about. A couple of you pointed out, hey, you know, I'm not upgrading every cycle anymore. I am moving to this more, longer model that we're talking about, where I'm not getting a new iPhone every year. And it's not just about, you know, not getting the latest and greatest thing or not wanting it. It's more about, hey, you know, I don't really need it. And I can use that money elsewhere. You know, I can do something else with that money and, you know, not be so, you know, not be so much into the consumption of my technology and my electronics devices. And I think that's, you know, that's a thing well worth thinking about. So if you have any thoughts and opinions on that, shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. The last thing that I want to do for today is I want to talk about my thing of the moment. I can't remember. I'm sure I've talked about this product in the past, but I don't think I've ever made it a pick, you know, a thing of the moment. And it's my Audio-Technica AT2005 USB mic. So it's AT2005 USB is the model number. They sell for about $70 on Amazon, $70 US, and it is the perfect portable recording microphone setup. And that's for a couple reasons. It's because it is a USB mic, but it is also an XLR mic. It has standard XLR input as well as USB input. So when you're out, you're ready to plug into a mixer as well as plug directly into a Mac or an iPad or an iPhone via USB. You can use Apple's Lightning to USB or USB or Lightning to USB 3 adapters. Either one will work. It doesn't need a lot of power. It's a dynamic cardioid. I guess it doesn't need any power at all. It's a dynamic cardioid mic. It offers onboard headphone monitoring, so you can, you know, actually monitor the audio right from the microphone itself. And it comes with everything you need, not just the mic, but all of the cables, both USB and XLR, plus a mic clip, so you can, you know, put it into a microphone stand. And it even comes with a little folding tripod stand that you can use on a desk. So if you're traveling and you want to record a podcast, or if you want to, you know, do a go-to meeting or some sort of business call or something like that on Skype, you can use the mic for that. You can sound really great. And it even comes with a little carrying case that everything fits into, and it's nice and compact, easy for travel. And it is, you know, it's my travel kit. So I take that with me. If I'm taking my MacBook, I'm going somewhere and I know I'm going to have to maybe do some podcast recording. That is really my mobile rig. And it's a great product. Again, around $70, the Audio-Technica AT2005 USB mic. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show's sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their software at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. I got one more little item of business for you. Actually, this is great. I know there are a number of truckers out there all over the world who listen to podcasts. I hear from many of you. And we have one fan of the MacCast, Trucker Bob. He emailed me to let me know that there is a new resource that they set up that, if you're a trucker, might interest you.
Hi, Adam. I wanted to let you and your listeners know that Todd McCann from the Trucker Dump podcast and I started a Slack channel for professional truck drivers who use Apple products. It's called the iTruckers Slack channel, and we discuss all things Apple regarding the trucking industry. We discuss things like iOS and OS 10 apps for trucking, troubleshooting and new features of software and how to use them. We even have a separate channel where we discuss podcasts. We have professional drivers from Canada, Europe, and the States subscribe to the channel. So I'd like to invite all professional drivers who use Apple products to join us on Slack. Just download the Slack app for iOS or OS 10 and send an email to itruckers@icloud.com asking for an invite, and we'll send you one. Thanks, Adam, for helping us get the word out.
Hey, you're welcome. And that sounds like a great channel. Like I said, I know many of you out there are truckers, and so this is a great, you know, sort of subsegment of our global community that I'm more than happy to help out. So check that out, the iTruckers Slack channel. Just shoot them an email and they'll get you all of the details you need to get involved with that. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send your audio comments and your emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in and leave a voicemail on the listener hotline. That telephone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you're on the social medias, the Twitters, the Facebookies, or the Google Plusy things, you can find me there. I am MacCast on Twitter. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.